This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the first full week of December, and the hot topic in the White House press briefing room this week was COVID tests. Specifically, whether the government is doing enough to get affordable tests in the hands of people who need them. The administration has touted the fact that it will be promulgating rules to require health insurance companies to reimburse the cost of home testing. But there are a few problems with that. One is that at-home rapid tests aren't just more expensive than in other countries, typically between $7 and $12 at retail, but they're often out of stock. Another is that $12, it's a lot more than the approximately $1 such a test might cost you in Germany, but it's also kind of a low dollar amount to expect people to file reimbursement paperwork for. As NPR reporter Mara Liasson put it in one of these briefings, that sounds like kind of a hassle.
We've cut the cost significantly over the past few months, and this effort to ensure insurers are you're able to get your tests refunded means 150 million Americans will be able to get free tests.
Complicated though. Why not just make them free and give them out to and have them available everywhere?
Should we just send one to every American?
Maybe.
Then what happens if every American has one test? How much does that cost? And then what happens after?
Of course, the third problem is that making health insurance companies reimburse doesn't actually make the costs of the tests free. It just means that your health insurer pays for it, that ends up flowing back through into premiums that are paid either by consumers or by their employers. And so the questions turn to, isn't there a better way to do this? I think this issue is important. It's going to be really important if the Omicron variant causes a big surge in cases, but I think the conversation about it has gotten a little off track. So to fix that, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Ross Douthat, columnist at the New York Times on the right. Hi, Ross.
Hello, Josh.
And on the left, Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. Hey, Liz.
Hi, Josh.
So on Wednesday, Jen Psaki basically got another crack at this, and she said something that I think is pretty reasonable, which is that, you know, we don't want a situation where millions and millions of tests are wasted. If you literally send a test to every American, some people aren't going to use the tests. It's not the best use of a limited resource. But I feel like we're off track here. The thing is that it should be possible in the United States to walk into a CVS store or Walmart and be confident that there are going to be COVID rapid tests available on the shelf, and we ought to be able to get the pricing down to where it is in peer countries, which is to say somewhere around a dollar a test. And it just, I feel like I'm going crazy when I look at our government, and it's not just that that's not the situation, but the attitude from government officials is basically like, why would you expect us to be able to do that? It just feels like really bizarre, almost defeatist messaging that is very different from the way that it felt like we on both sides of the aisle were approaching this crisis as of last year. Liz, what do you make of this?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that you're temporarily living in the psychological zone that leftists live in all the time, which is that, you know, on admittedly a much, much larger scale, there are all of these things that our peer nations are able to, because they have resources that are quite similar to ours, pull off for their citizenry that for some reason we are completely incapable of, and that we behave as though are impossible, though we have all of these examples to the contrary. But this is a small-scale example. We're not asking for universal health care or something that's really logistically difficult like that. We're talking about what's basically a matter of just production and distribution. And we were able to do it with vaccines, for example. The tests are a lot less sophisticated than that, and they definitely have fewer challenges with respect to distributing them to people, right? You don't need specialized personnel to get a test into a CVS. So I'm completely baffled by the fact that we, A, haven't done that already, as to where, you know, you compare us to the United Kingdom, where you can get multiple free in-home tests per week. And also why, you know, Jen Psaki in this case would behave as though it were ridiculous and sort of fantastical that somebody would even ask. I mean, of course, it's a good question. Why haven't we? And I don't think there's any obvious answer other than that in the United States, we have no reasonable expectation. We don't put a lot of pressure on our politicians for things like that. We expect to pay, and we expect there to be limited quantities of things available to limited numbers of people.
Well, not in CVS though. I mean, in CVS, you're supposed to have everything that you want at any time, right? Wasn't this the Bernie Sanders critique of American supermarkets, that we have just too much stuff, right? I mean, I just want to speak up for the, you know, the general abundance before supply chain issues, at least, of the typical American pharmacy.
Well, and there is a conservative critique available here, which is to say that, you know, one of the problems that has caused this shortage of tests is that the U.S. has a regulatory regime that makes it significantly more difficult to get these kinds of tests approved than it is in Europe. The FDA is slow and exacting, and there's some trade-off to be had here. Some of the tests are more sensitive than other tests, and the FDA has been very focused on setting a higher sensitivity standard for these tests that are released on the U.S. market. But then the practical effect is that you end up with a lot of people using no test, and no test has sensitivity right. of zero. So it seems like the European Union has struck a better balance there. One simple thing you could say is if the test is legal to use in Europe, we're just going to authorize it on an emergency basis to be used here. But there's sort of a, like, we can't do that attitude here. It's, I mean, you had that in Psaki's own answer that, well, those other countries don't have to go through the FDA approval process. That is a choice. It's a choice we could change. And there are a lot of things. I mean, the way that we developed these vaccines was not the regular FDA process. We came up with a new process because we needed it. And there's sort of this ossification of some of those regulatory apparatuses. And it feels like that's where I would be focusing on this if I were a conservative. There's an element of needing to get the government out of the way here.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think the FDA has a theory, basically, that if you release too many tests that offer too many false negatives, then people will get false negatives when they actually have COVID and go out and, you know, slobber all over each other at the holiday parties that, you know, we're still not actually allowed to have or something, right? So that's the theory. It's not, I guess, a crazy theory, but I think it's pretty obviously wrong that, in fact, you know, unless your false negative rate is really high, it's much better to have lots and lots of people testing all the time, because you are just going to catch a lot more cases, even if you do have some people, you know, going out with false confidence that they shouldn't have. I mean, I want to stress, because, you know, this has become kind of a big issue, and I put it in a column last week as an example of what the Biden administration could do better. I mean, this is not like a game changer, right? I mean, this is not, we're not going to end the pandemic by giving everybody at-home tests. This is something that makes a difference at best on the margins. I think it's more important to emphasize, for the reasons you've been suggesting, Josh, as kind of an illustration of, you know, I think an attitude that the Biden administration has fallen into a little bit generally, where, you know, they had a plan. The plan was to get everybody vaccinated and declare victory. That plan didn't work out as expected. And now there's just very little sort of creativity, it seems like, in their response. And look, I mean, it's hard. It's hard to deal with a constantly shifting and changing pandemic. And obviously, you know, the reality of vaccine resistance on the right is a big problem in American life. But I do feel like, you know, the Trump administration made 6,000 mistakes dealing with COVID, but they did do a few sort of genuinely creative things, or they did them in partnership with Democrats. They, you know, they did Operation Warp Speed. They sent checks to every American. They did these kind of things that fall into a kind of we can do it spirit. And I don't see a ton of that in the Biden White House right now.
Yeah, I made a wish list here of things where that missing creativity could add a lot of value. Now, some of these are things that Matt Iglesias wrote about this week in his newsletter. We have good evidence, for example, that it's better to space the first and second vaccine doses out farther, maybe about 8 weeks instead of three. We learned this because other countries, because of the supply issues, they did that sort of not because they were trying out a different dosing schedule, but because they just wanted to get as many first doses out as possible. And we found that the immune response that you get is actually better if you wait a little longer for the second dose. But we're not changing that as we vaccinate people who are getting vaccinated for the first time, which tends to especially be children right now, because there wasn't a randomized controlled trial of that. We just have this very good real-world evidence about it, but that's not how we do that. That's not how the FDA changes its recommendations about these things. There's this existing SSRI drug called fluvoxamine.
That's Zoloft, by the way.
Well, it's not Zoloft, it's Luvox. It's another SSRI. It's a similar antidepressant to Zoloft. there's some good evidence that it significantly reduces the risk of hospitalization and death in people with COVID by about 30%. And, you know, 30% isn't a great reduction, but it's about as good as this weird new Merck medication that they're on their way to approving. None of that's as good as the Pfizer thing that's coming down the pike. But if we can't rush those more, which we ought to be, by the way, I don't know why there isn't some big government program to say, you know, why can't we make many, many more times of these Pfizer pills that seem like they're going to do a lot of good to reduce the severity of COVID. We're not having the same kind of creativity with that as we had with the vaccines. But we also, why aren't we getting the fluvoxamine out there in a more organized manner? And it's also true on some of the economic stuff with the ports. There isn't the same all hands on deck mentality that we had about the vaccines for all the new problems that, as you noted, Ross, they weren't in the plan. The Biden administration doesn't seem to be eager enough about drawing up a new plan.
Well, there's also, this may change with the new variant, but right now, monoclonal antibodies are really effective, not universally effective, but really effective at treating COVID. And they're hard to deliver, right? There are challenges of delivery. It's a course of treatment. It's not just a pill that you can take. You have to inject them and all of these things. And so there have been all these sort of logistical challenges. But as a result, like at the peak, I mean, this is something the Times reported earlier this fall, at the peak of the summertime wave, we had all these hospitals that had only used like a half of their monoclonal antibodies allotment, even as people were actually dying. And what's good to see is the Biden administration is finally in their sort of winter pandemic plan saying, all right, we're going to have these strike teams to go around to hospitals and sort of help people administer monoclonal antibodies. But like in that case, it seemed like 6 months ago, this was something Ron DeSantis was doing in Florida. And so the Biden administration attitude was like, oh, you know, the governor who doesn't like vaccination wants to emphasize monoclonal antibodies, and we're just going to get everybody vaccinated and this will go away. But in fact, they could have been doing both. There could have been national strike teams 4 months ago for monoclonal antibodies. And it's just like, yeah, it just almost feels like this White House is run by a very old man. I'm just putting that out there, who may not be intensely engaged with some of these challenges. And, you know, not that Donald Trump was intensely engaged with all of these challenges, but somehow people at the layer below him did do a few important things.
But isn't this supposed to be Ron Klain's deal? Like, he was the pandemic guy? The White House chief of staff. I mean, I would, you know, the Republicans have taken to jokingly referring to him as the prime minister, because they're alleging basically what you're alleging, Ross, that the president is sort of checked out and it's really the administration being run at a staff level. But these seem like the sort of things that might actually get done better in an administration that was operated like that, because you have the people who were supposed to be good at this sort of creative thinking in charge there, allegedly too in charge, and yet it's not happening. The other reason that this drives me crazy is that it feels like, I mean, I know you're saying, you know, I sound like I'm experiencing what people on the left experience, and you know, the sort of where it's the better things aren't possible messaging from the administration. But it's like a lot of the things that the left asks for, as you note, are really big changes that, you know, the amount of increase in federal taxes and spending that you would need to go to full single payer in the United States is very large, and there are very large barriers to that. But these are like, you know, these are very small better things that we're looking for, that they really are possible. Like, and in fact, we saw the government flex in a lot of these ways just last year. The weird thing about the defeatism is that these are things that we actually really could win.
Right. I mean, that's an additional frustration in this particular situation is, you look at our peer nations, they have all also had to respond to this pandemic. They have come up with, you know, varying countries have come up with varying responses with varying levels of success. But I think we've seen shades of all of these different solutions that you're talking about play out in different countries that have had some levels of success, in Denmark, in the UK, in New Zealand, and so on and so forth. And it's just remarkable that in the United States, with the level of resources that we have, and the fact that I believe when you look at polling, and certainly when you just sort of take the temperature of the country, this is the thing that people consider a priority. Dealing with the pandemic is the number one priority for lots and lots of people. So it isn't as though the White House doesn't have a mandate to go all out on this. In fact, I think that would be very good for Biden, not only for his approval ratings, which are in trouble, as usual, at this point, but also just for the sort of psychology of the nation at large, and could probably even help the Democrats in the midterms. And nevertheless, you see these kind of slow and scattered responses. Every time there's a press conference from the Biden administration on new COVID responses or new COVID plans, I feel like it's the first time they're hearing of COVID-19, which is just remarkable, right? Because this is something that Biden ran knowing that he would have to deal with. And I, like you, am mystified by the fact that we still seem to be just discovering a few weeks late every time that there are these different solutions or strategies we could try that have had major success in our peer nations, or even coming to the conclusion that there's not going to be one single strategy and that we need to be chipping away with lots of different ones. I mean, it's possible that there is some concern about doing too many things. Perhaps Democrats are concerned that due to social distancing orders, lockdowns, and mask mandates, whatever they try to institute, they're going to pay for politically because those were so heavily protested. But especially when it comes to something like buying a test and making the decision to stay home, I don't necessarily think that's true. And so I am just totally baffled by how off guard the White House seems to be here.
And these problems also interconnect with each other. I mean, one of the political problems that we've seen for Democrats, especially in the Virginia elections, was discontent about the continued disruption of schools. Well, if you want to reduce the extent to which parents have to worry about the possibility that their kids are going to be quarantined, you need these test-to-stay regimes where you, when you have an exposure, instead of having to stay home for some substantial period, you test, you get a negative COVID test, and you keep going to school. But for that, you need the tests. And so, you know, I certainly lockdowns and other restrictions, those are a political hazard. A lot of this stuff, in addition to helping people avoid getting COVID, would help avoid some of those unpopular circumstances. And so that's, you know, yet another reason why I'm sort of mystified by the lack of creativity in this administration. But okay, I think that's probably enough complaining about that. Let's take a break, and I will be back with Ross Douthat of the New York Times and Elizabeth Brunig of the Atlantic to complain about Congress. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center. And we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow. On the right is Ross Douthat, columnist at the New York Times. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at the Atlantic. So as promised, we're going to complain about something else. Build back better. Congress is back at work. They struck a deal to prevent a government shutdown. They've found a convoluted way to raise the debt limit again. The bipartisan infrastructure framework is now law, and so President Biden has been out there touting that, saying it's not just infrastructure week, it's infrastructure decade. And Build Back Better, the package of social and climate spending that Democrats have been talking about for months, well, they are still talking about it, and Joe Manchin, senator from West Virginia, is still not ready to pass it. Now, of course, Democrats have exactly 50 seats in the Senate. They need every Democrat to agree to this package before it can move through and become law. And he says he's still worried about inflation. We need a clearer view on where that's going. That's more important than passing this bill quickly. But interestingly, Liz, another one of his objections to the bill that he's been focusing on is actually kind of similar to one that I've been hearing from you, which is he doesn't like the grab bag of temporary programs. He says it's a problem that the bill creates a number of programs and only funds them for a few years. Now, the way he couches this objection is saying that it's hiding the true cost of the programs, and that would be true if they really are going to get extended. But I'm not sure why he objects to this is the important thing so much as that he objects to this, because it seems like if he's serious about that, he could be pushing the bill in a direction that I think you have wanted the bill to get pushed, which is to say for it to do fewer things and to do them in a more robust, more permanent manner. So maybe Manchin's objections, even though they're delaying it, maybe they're going to produce a bill that's more satisfactory from your view than the draft that they have right now.
Yeah, I think that would be nice. I think in Manchin's case, I doubt that the objection is perhaps that principled, and maybe he's more just kind of objecting on all fronts with everything he can think of. You've heard similar objections to some of these proposals from recently Mitch McConnell, right? That there would be not even widespread participation in, for instance, this child care proposal.
Point of clarification, did not Mitch McConnell cite a public policy organization run by your husband?
He did.
Yeah, I just wanted to take note of that important moment in the space-time continuum. That's all.
We can indeed summon an expert if we'd like. But I think whether or not he's sincere, I think it's healthy on the whole that the problems with these proposals are making waves, that there's space in the discourse to talk about them, that it's not remaining a conversation that is great Democratic proposals are encountering totally unfair and ludicrous Republican resistance, because the fact of the matter is that there are some real problems with some of these Democratic proposals. And one of the real problems in the child care case, for instance, is that these programs will be temporary, that they will only be participated in by, it seems like, maybe a two-thirds of the state, that only two-thirds of children, perhaps is a better way to put it, would even benefit from these, and that a third would live in states that would not be participating at all. These are not all red states. Some are blue states, and their problem is that these programs would create temporary conditions and then would evaporate. And there are real logistical costs that come with temporarily standing up a program, creating conditions where people's lives come to rely on the existence of that program, and then disappearing. So you think about parents putting a couple of kids in a daycare center with major subsidies, and then in 3 years, it just goes away. Well, they have the same jobs. That's a serious problem. That's not a ridiculous complaint. So even if that's coming out of the mouth of Joe Manchin, and even if he's not the most sincere actor, I hope it'll draw attention of more reasonable Democratic legislators who actually have a mind to repair some of these flaws, because they are serious ones. And this is an unusual opportunity to move something like this through Congress. And I think it's pretty critical that we get it right.
Yeah, Ross, the temporary nature is disruptive in two ways. One is the one Liz describes there, where individuals have to adjust to the fact that these rules are likely to change from year to year. But it's also disruptive for the state and local governments that are actually supposed to operate a lot of these programs. And you see this in the pre-K as well, that it's not just temporary. It starts out with a fairly small amount of money, and then the money gets more robust, and then it goes away. And so that's hard for governments to plan around if they are, if they're standing up that program and they're relying on that federal government support. Are they going to have to find their own revenue sources for it? Are they going to have to shutter it? And so Liz says, maybe two-thirds of children are going to be in states that participate in this. I think we're likely to see lower numbers than that, because I think states are going to find that there are all sorts of real problems with trying to stand up these programs on a temporary basis. And I think the sort of sense that, oh, these things will be really popular and it'll get pushed out in a few years, I don't think as a political matter that that's true, especially if Democrats are not in control of the federal government when that comes down the line and the programs expire. So I think people sort of haven't really even fully gamed out what it's going to be like if these programs do become law, because I think a lot of the states are just going to pass on them.
Yeah, and they should. Not even necessarily because the money could go away under a Republican-controlled Washington, but also because the internal design of the programs often carries these sort of characteristic flaws in democratic welfare state expansions, where there's this, you know, this strong emphasis on sort of professionalization and credentialization. And, you know, you've got to have your new preschool teacher has to meet certain federally mandated thresholds for training and all of these things that in practice are likely to drive up the cost of childcare for a lot of people in the middle class in a way that has some parallels in what, you know, the way Obamacare ended up temporarily increasing prices for middle income health insurance consumers in ways that made it very unpopular. So I think if these programs took effect, there would be a kind of middle class parents backlash against them, at least as they've been designed to date. But since Liz is being graciously critical of the Democrats, I'll be critical of the Republicans and say, you know, in an ideal world, I think there is clearly a sort of natural right of center alternative to this sort of Democratic, you know, bureaucratic mess, which is to just give parents more cash. And the obvious sort of bipartisan compromise here would be to say, we're not going to set up some huge new childcare program that functionally discriminates against stay-at-home parents and parents who use grandparents and relatives for childcare. We're just going to increase the child tax credit and make it permanent. And there are a few Republicans who would be interested in this, but there are not enough, and there's not enough weight in the party behind the idea of bipartisanship to make this possible. So it's sort of left to Joe Manchin, who I don't think fundamentally cares deeply about these design questions. I agree with Liz. He seems to be more looking for sort of different critiques and different reasons to object. But, you know, in an ideal world, this would have played out like the infrastructure bill did, where you would have had a group of Republicans, you know, led by some combination of, you know, Mitt Romney style moderates and Marco Rubio style populists, getting together with Democrats and saying, you know, here's how we're going to expand the child tax credit, and we're not going to do these other things that Democratic interest groups want to do.
But Rubio opposes that. It's really just Mitt Romney that agrees.
Right now, it's just Mitt Romney. But even there, I think there is the Rubio complaint, right, is that these programs, you know, give money to parents who have no market income. And so it encourages parents to just, you know, end up permanently out of the workforce in a way that, you know, Republican critics of welfare programs before the mid-1990s reform were known to argue. But even there, I think if you sat down and had a good faith negotiation, you could come up with some kind of deal where, for instance, you could say we're going to extend cash strings free to new parents in the first year of their child's life, because we think that, you know, mothers should be home with their kids or should have the option to be home with their kids when they're newborns and infants. But then we aren't going to extend it for the full 5 years because we do want people to have some, you know, some attachment to the workforce, something like that. I'm just, you know, this is not a perfect compromise, but I think there are, if you were having good faith negotiations between the sort of moderate Democrats, Romney and Rubio, there could actually be common ground. But again, the Republican Party is not set up to find that common ground at all.
Let's take a break. I'll be back with Ross Douthat of the New York Times and Elizabeth Brunig of the Atlantic to talk about the Summit for Democracy. You're listening to Left, Right and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow. On the right is Ross Douthat, columnist at the New York Times. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at the Atlantic. This week, the White House is hosting the Summit for Democracy. It's a virtual summit on Zoom, who doesn't love those, and it has dual purposes. It's supposed to bolster the image of democracy and make a case for it as the right way to organize a society at a time when authoritarian powers like China are rising in influence. And it is also supposed to provide a forum for democratic countries to discuss the challenges they're facing within their own systems. But do these summits actually do anything? To talk about that, our special guest today is Paul D. Miller. Paul was a member of the National Security Council staff for 2 years, spanning the George W. Bush and Barack Obama administrations as director for Afghanistan and Pakistan. Before that, he was an intelligence analyst for the CIA and a military intelligence officer in the U.S. Army. Now he's a professor at Georgetown's School of Foreign Service and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Hi, Paul. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So what are these summits for?
They are for heads of state to meet each other, talk to each other, form relationships. They are for issuing public statements, communiques, to kind of signal their intent. I mean, it's a form of international virtue signaling, if you will. And so far as that goes, it can be fine. I think that the virtues being signaled are good. I think democracy is important. And I think President Biden and the other leaders of the summit are correct to understand that the fate of global democracy is important and imperiled. And so to that end, you know, the summit could be a good thing. I am worried that it could be only that and nothing more, in which case it could be a counterproductive exercise in public relations that doesn't have any more activity behind it.
So I guess, I realize this is a small question to start with, but does it actually form those meeting and networking purposes when the summit is purely virtual? I'm just sort of thinking about my own experiences going to, you know, obviously lower stakes in-person or virtual conferences than this one. But is it actually a useful vehicle for these leaders to get to know each other when they are not literally in the same room?
Probably not. I taught my classes over Zoom for 16 months, and it was definitely suboptimal. And I saw that there was less relationship building amongst the students and between me and the students. And I imagine it's going to be the same thing amongst world leaders. So yes, already the Summit of Democracy is starting off in a disadvantaged position where they're not going to be able to do that kind of hallway chit-chat that we all enjoy doing at our conferences and panels.
And so then what about the invite list for this? One of the criticisms that I've been seeing is that it's sort of some of the countries that have been invited, like Pakistan and the Philippines, are, you know, really do not have excellent democratic institutions. Meanwhile, Hungary has been forced to sit out, and there's been some democratic backsliding in Hungary, but it seems weird to try to claim that Hungary is less democratic than Pakistan. Does that undermine the purpose of the summit? I realize, you know, it's sort of the summit is for democracy, but it's also sort of trying to push back on Russia and China as world powers, right? Which is not precisely the same thing and doesn't necessarily lead to precisely the same list of who's good and who's bad.
You know, there is some value in including partially democratic countries. If you kind of bring them into the fold, perhaps it gives us opportunities, again, to form those relationships and then through private diplomacy, encourage more democratic reforms. That's actually how South Korea ended up making the transition to democracy in 1988. President Reagan picked up the phone, made a very key strategic but private phone call to encourage them not to crack down on the street protests that were happening in the country at that time. So if we form relationships, it might give the opportunity for that kind of private diplomacy. Again, a Zoom summit, there may be fewer opportunities like that, but we do what we can. So I hear the criticism, but I do want to say there might be some rationale towards including these partial democracies.
Liz, what have you made of this event? I mean, I know that in general, one of your refrains is that you would like to see the U.S. lean more on diplomacy as a way to make change around the world rather than the use of our military institutions. Do you see this summit as a hopeful move in that regard?
I like the idea of you know, diplomacy as opposed to military intervention. I think that's pretty well established. I think, like you and Mr. Miller, I have concerns about doing it via Zoom. The relationship building and networking that happens when people get together for summits and conferences in real life, that all happens off the books. That happens with like these little asides and conversations that people are having that are not scheduled or part of the formal event. This just happens when people sort of locate each other and like each other.
Yeah, I mean, Paul, it feels like that then leaves us with the sort of the formal part of these summits, which it's always this kind of like lame feeling rhetoric. It's sort of, you know, when I hear these set piece speeches, they don't sound like anything that's going to convince anybody or going to change anything. So what's the vehicle by which you come out of this and you turn that into some real change in the world in the way the countries relate to each other?
Yeah, I mean, we all know, we've all been to conferences and panels where people just read their talking points and you can predict in advance what they're going to say. The real work for a summit like this is actually done in several months before it happens, and it's done at the lower levels. The desk officers at the State Department, they've been working with their counterparts across the world probably to come up with a public statement or a communique expressing, you know, the solidarity and cohesion of the free world and how we have to stand for our values and that sort of thing. So that work has presumably been done or been going on for a few months, and that'll be a touchstone, a common point of reference going forward that democratic countries can look to and can point out and say, hey, look, this is what we stand for. This is why we think democracy is important, and this is why we need to push back on authoritarians. That's, I think, the most use we're going to get out of this summit. There's potential to the idea. It'd be better if it was in person. And again, I worry that there won't be enough action behind this, and it will be just a PR exercise. So I do hope to see some real action come out after this.
Yeah, I mean, I will endorse everything that the others have said about the pointlessness of holding a summit on Zoom. I mean, what's striking about this particular summit, obviously, is that it's happening at a moment when, you know, literally there is a possibility that Russia is contemplating a full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And there is a, you know, not quite as overt, but still sort of substantial fear that China has military designs on Taiwan at some point in the near future. And, you know, I would like to say something more encouraging, but I feel like there is a pretty stark contrast between the supposed leader of the free world literally convening the rest of the free world on Zoom, and the much, much more literal military pressure being brought to bear into, you know, what are understood, and I think you can argue about whether this understanding is correct, but what are understood as sort of two crucial theaters for the sort of defense of the Pax Americana or whatever's left of it. So if you were writing the sort of Barbara Tuchman style history book about this era, you know, you would draw out the contrast between a bunch of leaders gathering to have this hopeless virtual summit and, you know, the tanks doing maneuvers east of Donbass or something like that. That would be a, you know, a nice historian's flourish that would not reflect well on the condition of Western democracies at the moment.
I think Ross is kind of getting at what I refrain here, that I want to see more action come out of this. You're absolutely right that, you know, Russia, they know the playbook and they have more tools at their disposal than Zoom summits, and they're using it. And so is China. And so the Summit for Democracy, it's a fine thing. I'm not against it, but it is wildly insufficient to meet the challenges of the moment. And I think, Ross, you're absolutely right. We need to recognize what Russia's doing, what China's doing, and take appropriate commensurate countermeasures beyond the summit itself.
Well, and so let's talk specifically about Ukraine. What is appropriate countermeasures mean in this circumstance? The Ukraine would like to be a member of NATO. I don't think that's in the cards, and it doesn't seem to me. I don't see why the U.S. would make an ironclad military commitment to go to war over Ukraine. But then, what if we're not willing to do that? What do we do to deter the Russians from engaging in further aggression with regard to Ukraine?
Yeah, so I'm in the camp that says we should not fight World War III for Ukraine. We should actually save that card for somebody who is already in NATO. I'm in the camp that says we should fight World War III for Latvia because they are actually a member of NATO and Ukraine is not. President Biden has talked about more economic sanctions on Russia. Germany's talked about pulling the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. The United States is going to continue and probably ramp up its aid to the Ukrainian military. There's probably some covert stuff we can do, some cyber attacks, and there's going to be a diplomatic reaction to any Russian invasion, just a lot of international condemnation. That's all good. I would go just maybe a half step further, and I'm very comfortable with the U.S. military doing pretty much anything but direct hostile action against the Russian army. And that means direct intelligence support. If we use our ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, our satellites and our spies, if we help them see where the armies are, that could give them a qualitative advantage and really help them defend themselves, which they have, of course, every right to do. So I don't think it's a good idea for us to be in direct harm's way or to, you know, exchange hostile fire with the Russian army. But we can kind of get as close to that line as possible.
Is that good enough to stop Russia?
So the way I think about this, I think the goal isn't to win the war in Ukraine, because I think you may be right. I'm not sure we have enough tools in our toolbox to do that unless we actually put ground troops on the ground, which I don't think we should do. The goal actually is to make it as hard for Russia as possible so that they stop here and they don't try the next line. They don't try to invade Latvia. They don't try to invade Poland.
Can we talk about China for a moment? Because I mean the other big risk that you highlighted, Paul, was the possibility of more aggressive action by China toward Taiwan, and that again feels like an area where it's not clear what are the credible threats that we should be making there. Is that, you know, do we do World War III over Taiwan?
Yeah, that's a really hard case because. You know the history here. We had a mutual defense treaty with the Republic of China prior to 1979, I think. And then we, of course, abrogated that when we switched our recognition to the PRC. But Congress passed a law, the Taiwan Relations Act, mandating that the administration treat Taiwan as an ally, as a major non-NATO ally. And we've sold weapons to them every year since then to preserve their freedom. They are an ally in everything but name. And if we did not honor that alliance, it would be a pretty serious problem. That's why up until recently, American presidents have sought to maintain that strategic ambiguity and never really answer the question if we'll come to Taiwan's defense or not. I think the last two presidents have pretty much ended that and said we will. I think that at the minimum, we need to be ready to push back on China, just as I'm saying we need to push back on Russia. Words aren't enough. And we need to revive our alliances, we need to rebuild our military, and we need to be prepared for these kind of militarized crises, because that's the shape of the world to come, and we need to be a player in that if we care about preserving the liberal international order.
Liz, what do you make of that with regard to China?
Man, I think we need to think very, very, very carefully about the principles or alliances or agreements we have made that we would allow to draw us into a conflict that could be even distantly described as World War III. And it just seems like in a lot of these cases, the safest course of action for America, for Americans, is to recognize that we have a certain number of tools at our disposal, diplomatic tools, nonviolent tools, sanctions, and so forth, that we can use to exert some sort of influence over the other nations that we do business with globally. But it's not within our power to govern the activities of other countries, not universally. And so they're going to do things that we don't like, that we don't appreciate. And, you know, it's going to occasionally imperil the fortunes of other countries. We do that all the time. And it doesn't seem worthwhile to me, to them, to the nations that might fall prey to these greater powers like China and Russia, or to America, to go to war, to go to a major armed conflict. I would avoid that at almost every cost.
Say more about the almost, because that's exactly what we're getting at. You and I may actually find agreement here, because I think I agree with you. We should avoid it at almost all cost. The only thing worse is allowing essentially a Russian-Chinese conquest of Eurasia. And I promise you that would be worse for those countries. And probably for us as well. So tell me more about the almost. Under what conditions would you be willing to fight? What's the line you're willing to defend?
Third Reich scale genocide.
The Uyghurs in Xinjiang?
Well, I mean, that doesn't appear to be a Third Reich scale genocide, right? I mean, there are conflicting reports. A use of a nuclear weapon, you know, and which implies the planned use of further nuclear weapons, seems like the type of major international crisis in which one would have to intervene unwillingly.
What if China invaded Japan? Would we fight for Japan?
I feel like the Liz Brunig foreign policy would be like, in the great historical ledger, Japan kind of has it coming from China. considering the way we left it at the end of World War II. So I'm going to, you know, just sit this one out.
Does the great historical ledger matter? Like, no, I mean, the people who, you know, led the Japanese conquest of, you know, much of Asia and the Pacific, they're dead. Like, it's that now Japan is a free society that shares values with us in a way that China is not. I mean, I don't think what happened in the 1930s and 40s is relevant here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my answer would be it's not really any of our business, is it? We're not the United States World Police.
Well, it is quite literally our business because we're talking about our biggest trading partners around the world in Europe and in East Asia. And defending global prosperity is a way of preventing billions of people from falling into poverty. That's what we talk about when we're talking about defending the liberal international order. It's a system that has brought unprecedented peace, prosperity, stability to the world for 80 years. And I think that's worth defending. And it does depend upon these alliances. The alliance with Japan, the alliance with Europe, and those are good things worth preserving, and we have to fight to defend them.
The weird thing about that situation, though, with, you know, the economic relationships and, you know, China being such a large trading partner, is that we're simultaneously having this, like, less ambiguous than previous threat that we will engage militarily with China if they were to try to invade Taiwan. And at the same time, we can't even stop U.S. companies from having their own corporate messaging driven by the demands of the Chinese Communist Party. And if you are Marriott Hotels and you want to do business in China, you can't say that Taiwan is a country. And China is about to host the Winter Olympics. And all we are doing is saying, well, we're not going to send any political officials to that. We're doing a diplomatic boycott. It just it feels really strange to you know, say, you know, we're still the world's one superpower and we have all of these military threats that we can make. And at the same time, we, you know, we have so little ability even to do that kind of soft influence that we might expect to have.
I mean, I think just to sort of play the middle of this a little bit too. I think the description, I brought up Japan in part, you know, to sort of push Liz, but also because I think it's an example of the difference between the situation in Russia's near abroad and the situation in East Asia, where the countries sort of in the line of fire from Chinese aggression potentially are in fact, you know, including Taiwan, deeply bound to us with both sort of diplomatic history and actual deep economic relationships. And you can argue that that's true of part of Eastern Europe at this stage. You can't argue at all that it's true of Ukraine. And I think that difference has to drive U.S. foreign policy to some extent, right? That, you know, part of the reason we worry more about China vis-a-vis Taiwan than Russia vis-a-vis Ukraine is that our relationship to Ukraine and our relationship to Taiwan are quite different.
Yeah, no, I think I'd agree with that. And again, I just stress again, Ukraine's not a member of NATO. And so we have no kind of public commitment to them. You know, NATO's promised them future membership, but they're not there yet. We have to pick a line to defend. And I think the line is NATO membership. If we don't defend that line, then where will you defend? Will you defend, you know, Germany? Will you defend France? Will you defend the United Kingdom? Will you defend the Atlantic Ocean, right? So you got to pick a line. And I think we have already picked a line, and it's NATO. And that's where we defend. And the same thing with our alliances in the Pacific.
If you'll pardon me, I thought the line was global commerce. That's what we're really protecting, right? Is the flow of money across the globe. That's what's created the liberal world order. All this peace and prosperity is the flow of capital. And we have to defend that at all costs, right? So, I mean, what does it matter if they're in NATO or not?
You know, I said before, we do need to push back on Russian aggression in Ukraine short of war, because it's important to defend some principles, the principles of territorial inviolability, the principles of national sovereignty, and yes, the principles of a free world order. So we should push back. It is important. It's not as important as Taiwan or as NATO.
We're going to have to leave that there. Paul D. Miller is professor at Georgetown School of Foreign Service and a senior fellow with the Atlanta Council. Paul, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Ross Douthat, it's your soapbox.
Is it okay that I do something that I've already written a column about?
Nope. Improv.
Yes.
I can recycle. Okay. All right.
Off the cuff right now.
I know we're not supposed to recycle ideas from inside the show. I want to rant about, you know, whether Liz is willing to fight to defend Connecticut, which is the, no. the real homeland, the fatherland.
I think the real analogy there is Rhode Island. Do we fight to defend Rhode Island? Was Union expansion to Rhode Island?
Why
wise?
Would you think that I would be A, no, and B, why would you think I'd be sympathetic to Japan?
I didn't. That's why I asked. No, precisely. That's why it's a good content. It's a good show, right?
Yes.
Liz, okay, if I had been expecting you to defend Japan, I wouldn't have asked. So my rant is about a recurring critique of the mainstream American press that comes from press critics, people like Jay Rosen at New York University and other writers, and in the last week took the form of a column by Dana Milbank at the Washington Post, which basically assailed the mainstream media for being too negative about Joe Biden at a time when democracy is in the balance. And if you cover Joe Biden as negatively as you covered Trump, you are giving aid and comfort to a Trumpian restoration, another insurrection, all that kind of thing. And I think this attitude is totally wrong. I think it totally misunderstands much of what happened in the American media during the Trump presidency itself, when the media took exactly the posture of constant alarm about the state of democracy that these critics are urging. And the result was a lot of quite bad media coverage that actually probably helped Trump by undercutting the credibility of the media itself. And I think, you know, at the moment, you have Joe Biden has real problems, and these problems are not the creation of the media. They're the result of some forces beyond this White House's control, some forces that might be within the White House's control. And the only question shaping whether Donald Trump will return in 2024 is what happens in the world and how the Biden White House responds to it. And the idea that you could have the media burying, you know, bad COVID news or bad foreign policy news below the fold and just running headline after headline saying Donald Trump still a threat to democracy, and that would work out in any way to Biden's benefit, the Democrats' benefit, or democracy's benefit just strikes me as crazy.
Liz Brunick, what's on your mind?
This past Monday, as I held my kindergartner's hair back as she spewed puke mostly into the toilet but somewhat on my feet, I felt like I was in college again. But in college, I could have easily stayed home with her the next day doing nothing, and I would have been home anyway because, of course, everything that comes out of a kid's mouth is hyper-transmissible. The entire family was quickly felled with norovirus, and the reason she brought it home was that she picked it up at school. The reason kids go to school sick is sometimes because their parents don't realize they're sick yet, but a lot of times it's because their parents just can't stay home with them. There's a lot of stuff wrong with the United States, and I don't like any of it. But one thing that continually just drives me absolutely up the wall is that there are so many workplaces that don't provide even halfway reasonable family leave policies that parents are left with little choice but to take their kids to school sick. It serves as free childcare. If your kid's in public school, that's a place to put them for the day that they will be safe, where you know you can pick them up at the end of the day and they'll be taken care of. You can go to work, and if you rely on hours to collect your wages, then you have to. We really, 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 especially in cases of hyper-transmissible illnesses and in periods of pandemic, need to institute some sort of family leave policy that allows people to stay home with their kids when they're sick, until they're well, which often means until after they're not symptomatic anymore. Why? Because I don't want any other family to have to go through the level of bleaching I just did in this hellhole my house has become.
For my rant, there's been another round of debate this week about Latinx, driven by another poll showing that this is a term that almost no Hispanic or Latino Americans use. And liberals and media institutions and organizations that have adopted this term to refer to the Latino community at large sound out of touch because they are being out of touch. But people are sort of misunderstanding the key problem here in a way that Arizona Congressman Ruben Gallego correctly identified. The problem is not so much that the term Latinx annoys a lot of U.S. Latinos, though it does. The problem is that if you're saying it, that's a sign that you're probably not doing your homework in understanding Latino communities, how they feel, what they want, and how they refer to themselves. And so that's the question, really, that Democrats and media organizations, anyone who's adopted this term, trying to understand what else have you gotten wrong? What are you not understanding? And maybe if you're a Democrat, what does that say about why you've been losing ground in South Texas and South Florida and other places with large Hispanic populations? It's an important question if you want to try to win in 2022. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Elizabeth Brunig, Ross Douthat, and Paul D. Miller. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our production fellow is Nisha Venkat. The show is recorded and mixed by Nick Lamponi. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more of Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.